Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Yaron Brook Radio Show. I'm Ilan Jerno, sitting in for Yaron today. We're coming to you from the studio at the Ayn Rand Institute, and we are here to talk about Ayn Rand's ideas, their application to life and the world and the culture around us. We stand for reason, egoism, and capitalism, and we are carrying the torch for those ideas in today's world. So welcome to the program. I hope you are excited as I am. It's been a while since I hosted the show in Yaron's place. Where is Yaron today? That's a great question. I was just looking at the Ayn Rand Institute's page of events, and he is, it seems like he's in a different country every day this week. Today he is in Paris. Tomorrow he's in London. The day after is in Ireland. And the list goes on. So he's traveling throughout Europe at the moment giving talks. And if you're interested in where he is or where some of our other speakers are going to be presenting talks and so on, go to aynrand.org/events. I'll be in Denver this week at an event hosted by the Leadership Program of the Rockies, and I'm thrilled about that. My topic is going to be the defense of American rights, principles, not pragmatism. And if you don't know about the program, Leadership Program of the Rockies, I encourage you to find out. It's an interesting program. I've been speaking there. It's my second time, and I'm delighted to join them. So today's program, I'm going to give you a quick high-level overview of some of the things I want to cover in the next hour and a half or so. First, I want to tell you a bit about stuff coming up that the Institute's putting on, events and conferences, and why I'm so excited about them and why you should be too. I want to talk about what it is what does it mean to have an elite, and specifically a foreign policy elite? We've heard a lot about that in the debates and the presidential campaigns, and mostly in the negative, almost entirely in the negative. They're a bad thing, many people say. So what is it that people are inveighing against? What are they challenging? What is it that we're supposed to be rejecting when people talk about an elite? And that's one topic I'm interested in talking to you about today. And another one is what is known as radicalization, or the transformation of people into jihadis specifically, though it happens, it's understood to happen to other kinds of movements. So I'm interested in talking about that and exploring that issue in a bit more depth. Another topic I think we'll get to, time permitting, is some of the developments in the Middle East, particularly in the Israeli context, a topic that I've been researching and writing about, and I want to tell you about what's happening there and also about the work that I'm doing, some of which will come to light soon. So I want to tease that a little. And then near the close of the program today, I'm going to share with you some things that I find particularly inspiring, encouraging, and just downright fascinating, I think worth your attention. And one very strong recommendation for a book that's come out recently that I'm going to tell you about that I think you will find valuable and that you will want to share with people. So that's an overview of what we're going to talk about today. I'm going to start with something that I've been thinking about quite a lot lately, which is the Objectivist Summer Conference, which is taking place July 2nd through 7th, basically, in Seattle, Washington. So what is this? This is an annual event that we at the Institute put on. It's sort of a forum for intellectuals and scholars and other people who are interested in Ayn Rand's ideas to present their work. And beyond the lectures and the panels and the debates and so forth, what we have is just an amazing group of people who come just to learn more and enrich their lives and meet other people who are interested in Ayn Rand's ideas. And so I just want to say a few things about why it's such a fun event and exciting. I've been going to Objectivist conferences for quite a long time. I was trying to do the math earlier today when I was preparing for the show. And I think I started when I was 18, when I was in college. So it's been a long time. And I've enjoyed attending these conferences. One of the, what is it that I have found so enjoyable? Well, I mean, I think the primary has always been for me, given my career interest, is learning more about Ayn Rand's ideas. What do they stand for? What do they not stand for? And just seeing their applications and their explanations. And I've found that I've learned a lot over the years. I can think of specific talks, for example. Leonard Peikoff gave a series of lectures many years ago at a number of these conferences that I look at the notes from those sometimes, and I remember insights that he presented there that have really helped clarify my thinking. And that's been true over the years from different talks and panels. And I've also been presenting at the conference. I can give you the perspective of a speaker. One of the fun things about speaking at a conference like this is that the people who come are super motivated. I've given talks all around the country. I've given talks to different kinds of audiences, students, people who are active in politics. I've spoken on Capitol Hill. I've spoken to sort of wonkish audiences. So I have, I think, a reasonably broad spectrum of experience. I've also spoken to a lot of college students over the years. And one of the things I find at OCOM, which is unusual in a good way, is that the people who come to listen are interested, and they've spent a lot of time and money to bring themselves to the venue. So they're motivated to hear, and you get good questions and challenging questions often. And I always like that. I find that one of the biggest benefits to me as a speaker at the conference is to get those kinds of questions from people, because one of the things you learn is that writing is difficult, but speaking is also difficult in its own ways. And in both cases, you learn a great deal by trying to explain your view to other people and seeing what they understand from it and what they don't, and then thinking about how well you did in trying to articulate your views. And when you get questions, the questions themselves are revealing of how clear the presentation was and what audience you're speaking to and what they came in understanding and what you've managed to leave them with. And to me, that I always find speaking to audiences like that to be an accelerant to my own clarity. And often it gets me, I figure out how to say things in a talk or in a course that then I think, well, that was a lot clearer than the first few drafts of something I've been trying to write for so long. So it's a fun experience to get kind of motivated audiences, challenging questions, and just a forum that's benevolent and welcoming of these ideas, which I think are really important and profoundly influential. And they've changed my life, and I know they've changed the lives of a lot of the people who attend the conference. And for those of you listening, whether you're new to Ayn Rand or you've been studying her ideas for a long time, it's a great opportunity for you to come and learn and deepen your knowledge. Let me make one thing. I want to emphasize one thing about OCON. So if you're on the fence about whether to come or not, I'll say this. My view is that the people who come, there's no expectation that you agree with everything that Ayn Rand has to say. The only thing that is important is that you are interested in learning more. And I think that's a really broad category. So if you're not sure how much you agree with, that's all the more reason to come and find out what she actually stood for. What are the applications of her ideas? And what does it look like to think about them seriously? And so those are really important things to consider if you're deciding whether to come or not. I'll mention one other thing that people, I think if they've never been to an objectivist conference, they might not really appreciate this, because you have to be there. It's like a joke. You have to be there to appreciate the humor, and you have to be at a conference to appreciate this aspect of it, which is, there's a whole dimension, a social dimension to it that you can't ever capture online. So if you're active in discussion boards, or if you're on Facebook and Twitter and you're engaged with people, you debate, you meet friends and so on, those are important to lots of people and there's value in that, I understand. That doesn't begin to capture what it's like to meet actual people and engage with them, talk to them, find out about their views on things. And speaking for myself, having gone to a number of conferences over the years, I've met super interesting people. Some people who are not so interesting, but that's normal. That's just the range of human experience. But let me emphasize the people I've met, and some of them become lifelong friends. Some of them they're not my friends, but are people I admire immensely. And just listening to them and learning from them is a great pleasure, and has enriched my life. So there's a whole social dimension that I think it's important not to underestimate, and it's a good motive to come if you want to meet people and just make a connection, particularly because Ayn Rand's ideas, and particularly for people who are trying to apply them in their own lives, it's valuable to have a community that you engage with and you learn from and you can form bonds with, whether that means you make friends or you just find people that share your interests beyond interest in philosophy. So there's a whole, there's far more to it than that. So that's my personal perspective on Ocon, why I'm excited. I've been to Seattle a few times. I was there in the spring most recently at an ARI event, and it's a beautiful place if you haven't been. I'm looking forward to the conference. I'm speaking there. I think I'm giving a couple of presentations, maybe three. I have to look at my schedule more carefully. But a couple of things I would highlight for you guys. I'm really excited about a couple of the keynote lectures. Ankar Gatte is going to be speaking, and so will Yaron. And the first two keynotes are about the objectivist movement itself, and then of the objectivist movement in contrast or in comparison to libertarianism, which I think is a super interesting topic, and one on which there hasn't been enough said, not in the sense that there's a lot to say about what the world looks like today. What is libertarianism? Has it changed? What does it actually mean to talk about libertarianism? And what is objectivism? Is it just another political movement? I don't think it is. It's a philosophical movement. And what does that actually mean? So those are a couple of things I'm excited to watch and learn from. And then a couple of other talks that caught my attention, because I know some of the individuals, at least in passing. There's a presentation about the entrepreneurship business and the spirit of Silicon Valley, which just the title alone would get me to sign up to the event. And I know some of the individuals, or I know them by reputation. They're involved in startups and technology companies and so on. And they're really interesting speakers and dynamic. So that is something on my highlights list. I could go through the whole, I could spend the rest of the hour giving you things that I'm excited about, but let's draw a line there and just say, if you haven't signed up for the Objectivist Summer Conference and you're thinking about it, do give it a lot more thought. You can find out more information at objectivistconferences.com, or you can go to aynrand.org/events to get more details about the event. All right, so that's the Objectivist Summer Conference in July in Seattle. I hope to meet you there. If you do come, and if we haven't crossed paths before, please come and introduce yourself. I'd love to meet some of the listeners to the show. All right, let's switch gears and talk about something that has been a feature of American politics, not just in this presidential campaign, but for a long time, many decades. And I'm talking about the issue of the antipathy or the animosity even towards elites. And let me just say, as I talk about this topic, I'm going to put elites in air quotes. You can't see me doing it, but I'll try to indicate that. And just take as a given until we get it deeper into what does it mean, what is this concept trying to refer to. I'm not accepting the concept as it's generally used, but let's first understand what is it that people have against elites? What is the beef here? And I think there is a real issue. It's not just that people on the campaign trail can score easy points with their constituents or their would-be voters by hammering on the elites that are destroying the world and the bad people in Washington and so on. There is a phenomenon here. There's really something to criticize, but there's also something here. There's much more to it. And part of what I want to do is just disentangle this issue so that we can get clear on it. And as a result, really evaluate what is there here to criticize. Is there anything here that deserves praise? And what are some of the sources of this kind of animosity? And I'm not sure if animosity captures it, because it's a big phenomenon, this whole sort of negative view of elites. I'm not going to talk about the issue in its broadest phenomenon, in its broadest scope. I'm going to pick just this aspect, carving out the issue of foreign policy elites, which I think has been a feature of the campaign most recently. So the basic issue is this. Do we need them? Do we need a foreign policy elite? And what does that even look like? If you listen to people like Donald Trump and some of the other former candidates, we don't need them. They're bad. They have brought us to disaster and ruin. The foreign policy elite are a bad lot. You know, we just need to get rid of them in order to find a path to a better future. And then the other way in which this has come up in the presidential campaign is there have been people who have written about, there's an article in the Washington Post a while back, which raised this issue of, well, you know, the foreign policy elites are a problem. What we really need, or more generally, the people running for office are not appealing. What we really need is to draft in former generals of the U.S. military and have them run for office because they know what they're doing. And the response to this was, no, they're part of the problem. They're part of the elite. They used to be their establishment figures. Let's not go down that path. I don't think anyone's still seriously talking about drafting in former generals. And the one person that came prominently recommended was former CIA director, and he before that he was very high up in the military, David Petraeus. You might remember him. So we'll come back to that in a moment. So let's talk about this issue. What does it mean to criticize the foreign policy? What is the reference here? What is the issue? And if you dig into this, you'll find, I mentioned Donald Trump, and I'm not going to hammer on him. He's not the only one who has this view, so let's broaden it. People like Richard Nixon were saying this something like 40, 50 years ago. The whole idea of we don't want these eggheads in here, they're just trouble. And let me give you a flavor of this view. So when Richard Nixon came into office, this is according to an article I found recently in the New York Times, he told his advisors he doesn't want anyone from the Eastern elite, Eastern Seaboard elite, and especially no one from Harvard. And I'm going to quote this, and this is what my kids might call a bad word in here. None of them in the cabinet, do you understand? Said Nixon. None of those Harvard bastards. End quote. And he was really adamant about this up until the point at which he appointed Henry Kissinger, who was at the time a Harvard professor, to be his foreign policy advisor. And you can't get more Harvard than Henry Kissinger, who was a very eminent diplomat and scholar of diplomacy and foreign policy. So that brings us to part of what is the core of the issue here, which is this is the wider context is that there is such a thing as an establishment, intellectual establishment, political establishment, and that's a related point. I'm not going to get into that. And there's interesting things that Ayn Rand has to say about the phenomenon of an establishment, particularly in academia. She has an essay called "Establishing the Establishment." I'm going to just carve out the aspect about foreign policy elites who are seen to be part of an establishment and who are seen to be bad and destructive and unnecessary and an obstacle. And yet at the same time, and this is part of the argument that this piece in the New York Times makes, they're needed. And why is that? Well, you can't just walk off the street and figure out what foreign policy should look like. You need to understand at minimum the geography, you need to understand the politics, the history of different parts of the world. And, you know, that's not what most people have in their minds. This is not an area that most people specialize in or have deep knowledge. So there's clearly a need for knowledge in this context, as there is in every area of life. So how, what does it mean to be against an elite who in the foreign policy world? Well, let's get into this. So the arguments against them are basically this. So they're above us. There's a sense in which they have power, and they are who wants these academics in charge, right? Who wants these experts? Excuse me. Who wants these experts to be running the show? And this is so they don't know the real world in effect, and the idea is that. And egghead is a word that was used prominently at the time of the Eisenhower administration. So that was his view of the people who would be filling his cabinet, and he's worried about that. So it shows you it goes back a long way. So what we have is some of the issue of foreign policy and how to navigate it is complicated. There's definite knowledge that you need, but at the same time, there's resistance to the people who would do it. So the question is why? Well, strangely enough, the article that I was referring to, and its title is Why We Need a Foreign Policy Elite. It goes on to make a case for why we do. So let's listen to the case and just evaluate it. The case is, I've given you one of the claims, which is it's complicated and you need people with real knowledge of the field. And what does that really look like? Well, the world, as the article points out, required experience and expertise, and that is what you get if you really delve into the issue and know its history and have deep knowledge of it. And if you think about in the Cold War period, that meant you understood and studied in depth the Soviet system and their thinking, and there's this whole field that is informally known as Kremlinology, which is trying to understand the irrational policies of the Kremlin, which was where the seat of the Soviet regime was. And as a real issue, like, well, how do you make sense of what the Soviet Union is trying to do? Now, this is the interesting part. In making the argument that, well, it's complicated and you need knowledge, here's what the article is saying in favor of having an elite. Well, they were needed, but it's also true that they weren't perfect, so they made mistakes. And among the mistakes, this is what the article is saying. The people who formed part of the Kennedy administration were known as the best and brightest for this reason. They were the elites, and the article says they bear the blame for Vietnam and the 58,000 American soldiers who died there, not to mention all the Vietnamese who died in the war. So the argument for having elites is that it's complicated, you need experts, and by the way, you know, they get some of these things wrong. Okay, so it's difficult. Got it. Now, this is the makings of what this indicates, why people look at this and they frown and say, well, that doesn't make any sense. But you're saying that they are getting things wrong and that's okay. How can that possibly be okay? Well, here's more of that from a different perspective. So this is another article arguing against the need for them. Who cares what they say? And it makes basically two points. And it's not denying the fact that things are complicated, that we need expertise, but it says the following. Why should we listen to them? Look how wrong they've been, systematically wrong. They gave us the Iraq War. They gave us the policy we now see in the Middle East. And essentially more than a decade of America being stuck in a quagmire. And that's not even counting Vietnam, right? It's just the recent problems we've had in the Middle East. And this is more on the theme of these elites are more trouble than they're worth. Yeah, it's complicated, and yeah, we need to know stuff. But look at how bad things have turned out under their watch. Now, there's a further aspect to the argument against them, which is these are people who, particularly in a policy context where they have influence in government and they shape it, they have power to send people into war, as they've done and repeatedly done in disastrous ways, which means the power to send people to die. And that means they could advocate for the draft, military draft, they could advocate for initiating wars, and these go on and on. And that obviously puts people's lives in danger and causes enormous dislocations in society. So you can see that the argument that, well, you need knowledge by itself isn't enough. And the arguments against it, against the idea of having elites, it's pretty compelling. Well, look how badly things have turned out to the extent that we've had these people running the show. And who can really trust them with so much power? And I can't remember the exact words for this. And he's not my favorite person to quote, and I'd rather find another source. But there's a famous quip that I think is attributed to the guy who ran National Review, William F. Buckley. And I think he said something like, I'd rather be governed by the first 1,000 names in the Boston phone book than the professors at Harvard. I'm not getting that exactly right. And that gives you a flavor of that kind of resistance to elites in power, in government. Now, there's certain ironies in Buckley saying things like that, but it's definitely a mentality that you see in America. And there's elements of it which are entirely understandable and elements of it which are really wrong, and some of it is actually corrupt. So I've set up sort of the argument that, well, we need them because it's complicated, but we don't need them. That's the opposing argument, because look at how bad things are and the disasters they've caused. Think of Vietnam, think of Iraq, think of Afghanistan even. And who wants those people running your lives? And this way, and then I'm not going to talk about their impact domestically, but there's a whole extension of this argument to the role of so-called elites in the Obama administration and the whole proliferation of domestic policy czars, if you remember that earlier on in his administration. And it's a similar issue, which is they're gonna control our lives in the way in which Plato's philosopher kings were supposed to do. So we don't want them bearing down on us and controlling our lives. So let's unpack this a bit, because it doesn't really add up. It doesn't integrate. So when you think of an elite, what comes to mind? It can't. It's not exhausted by people who run certain government departments or come up with policy. You have to think more broadly and think about, well, it means someone who has superior ability or knowledge or expertise. Now, also negative connotations, but let's focus on that, which I think is the primary. So who is an elite? Michael Jordan is an elite basketball player. From watching him play on TV years ago, I can tell you that, and I'm not a big basketball fan, even I can tell you, he was a superb basketball player. He is an elite basketball player. He's far better than Yaron, let's put it that way. And Yaron is the first to admit that. Who else is in elite? SEAL Team 6, if you remember them, they were the team sent to get Osama bin Laden under cover of darkness in Afghanistan 5 years ago. And they did the job well, outstandingly well. Now, you send in those people because they have been trained to a high level. Their expertise in doing this kind of work is above and beyond anyone's capability. They have distinguished themselves in their skills and knowledge of how to carry out such operations. If you sent me, I wouldn't get very far. I'm not at all remotely trained or even have the stomach for that kind of thing. Nor would practically most people on the planet. This is a very specialized kind of skill, just as playing in the NBA and scoring the way Michael Jordan did is an exceptional ability gained through lots of training and experience. Now, you can multiply this in many different directions. A doctor who performs surgeries to a high level in very complicated cases that is someone who is either in the elite or very close to being elite in his field. And notice that when you take it out of the context of policy or where there's sort of humanities or social science considerations where values and moral principles are more salient as they are in policy, it's clearer to see what counts as expertise and skill and superior ability. To put it bluntly, you know, I can figure out how to carve a Thanksgiving turkey. I can look it up on Google and I can practice a few times. I'll get to be competent at some point. But even if I were competent to carve a Thanksgiving turkey this fall, that you don't want me trying to remove your appendix, right? There's a clear gap between my ability and that of a surgeon who's been trained and who's had 10 years of experience. And the same thing applies in many directions. You could talk about, you know, I can Google information about my car and I go to the mechanic and say, you know, I think it's a carburetor. And the mechanic will rightly say, your car does not have a carburetor. It doesn't work that way. And that will be true because I don't know the first thing about how my car actually operates. So it's important to see that there is a reality to having deep knowledge and expertise and skill. And under that, you can capture the distinction of there are people with an outstanding level or a degree of ability that is just outstrips practically everyone else. And you can call them the elite. You could go to an elite mechanic. In other words, the guy who is practically like going to a pit crew on Formula One. Like he's the best you could possibly imagine. And the same applies in medicine. Now, the same should apply in every field that you can single out the people who have the skill and the knowledge that are far and away to a highest degree and clarity and so on. But where this becomes more complicated to understand is when you get into fields where the standards are harder to determine, or there might not even be standards defined. And that's often the case when you deal with things like policy and foreign policy. And the issue there is that it becomes clouded where you can be an expert in foreign policy and know the history of it and know the background of a region and speak the languages and know people on the ground and know people in government. And all those things are super important. But you also have views about what policy should look like and how the world ought to operate. In other words, you have views about morality and what political principles should be guiding it, whether you know it or not, how explicit they are. Those are questions, but it's unavoidable that your views on policy will be shaped by those premises, those philosophic premises. So what you end up with is that people in those positions who are in government or shaping government policy from the outside, they are a certain, and they're in a legitimate sense, they can be described as an elite and having a degree of knowledge and expertise that is outstanding. But it's also true that their ideas are either true or false. Their principles they advocate are either good or bad. And those are inseparable. You can distinguish between them and you can separate them, but it's their advice and what they implement as policy is shaped by their ideas. And what you have are people with lots of knowledge and lots of really bad ideas. And it's not an accident that what those ideas lead to are disastrous policies and ruinous initiatives. So in a certain sense, you could say, well, they give a bad name to the elite because they get things wrong so much. And that's a charitable interpretation, but I don't think that fully gets the issue. And that's because often what you get, and there was a certain movement at the beginning of the 20th century called the progressives who elevated the idea of technical knowledge as if you could have it in the absence of normative knowledge about how things should be, the moral values and political ideas that should shape it. And their view is that you just need to know efficiency in policy, and that's really all there is to it. And with the pretense, I think, that moral ideas are not coming into play, and yet they do. So there's from one side of this issue, there were people, and I think they're still there today. Definitely there were people like this in the Obama administration whose view is that they know best, and they do in effect have the Platonic philosopher king premise that we know best, and all of you people out there, we're just going to tell you what's right. You're not in a position to judge. You can't question us. So it's a combination of not high degree of knowledge, really bad ideas, and a desire to have power over people that's illegitimate. So there's three things that are important to separate out. There's real knowledge that's important and necessary, and that's true in every field. And the more you have, the better equipped you are to deal with issues. There's also the issue of what is what kind of ideas are you implementing? What are your moral and political ideas that shape policy? Are they good or bad? Are they right or wrong? Are they true or false? Are they pro-America or anti-America? Are they pro our self-interest or not? And that doesn't even begin to exhaust the possibilities, but that's the essential issue. Are they right or wrong? And on top of it, you get the fact of being in power gives you, being in government power gives you a kind of control over people's lives that can attract some of the worst people. And it's partly because government has powers that exceed its proper function of protecting individual rights. So what you get is the elite becomes more than just they've given themselves a bad name. The elite becomes something that is both, that is a package deal in Ayn Rand's term, which means it puts together things that don't really go together, that don't belong, and that need to be distinguished, but then are experienced in the world in this way, that are seen this way as going together, which is people who have knowledge, which is good, people who hold and want more power over you, which is very, very bad, and and the consequences of their power has been destructive. So it's not just their batting average is bad, it's that they have really bad ideas and that's important to challenge and expose. So those are some of the aspects that have to be separated out. And I think it's important, and as I said, I'm just identifying elements of this broader issue, but it's really important to see that this is a conception, this idea of elite, which I'm again putting in air quotes, is capturing a package deal, things that don't really go together. Because look at it a different way. You need people who know things. It's important to have expertise and deep knowledge. But it's also important to have good ideas and to shape government towards the right outcomes. So clearly it's wrong to dismiss those virtuous qualities merely because the people now in power and the people now defined or filling that role have bad ideas and leading us in the wrong direction. So this is a way in which it's corrupting of our thinking, of our thought and our understanding to view this group as an elite and to criticize them in those terms, because that's criticizing things that are right and necessary and things that are wrong and destructive all in one package. And that's, you can't really make sense of it that way. Now, as I said, this is a broader issue and it integrates in certain ways with the phenomenon of an establishment and an intellectual orthodoxy as well. But there's one other aspect that I want to draw out, and it relates to foreign policy elites and sort of the arguments around them, which is, it comes from a different direction, which is that the criticism of them hinges on this package deal and this union of things that shouldn't go together and that should be separated out. Because you can't criticize an elite uniformly, because they're good people who are in elite positions and they should be. And in doing one of the corrosive effects of this package deal is that it minimizes the reality that knowledge is good and it's important and you need it and there's really hard problems to solve in policy and in other contexts in the culture. So this is one of the ways in which package deals are destructive of our knowledge and thinking. But there's one other thing I want to say in connection with this, which comes from the sort of the perspective of people who are active in politics or who are voters and whose animosity to the elite is part of the phenomenon. And so I've met people like this, and there's some of them are sophisticated and educated. I was at an event for lawyers run here, sort of a lunchtime lecture series. I think it was affiliated with the Federalist Society, I forget, but it was for lawyers who are interested in politics. And one of the questions clearly evinced this kind of mentality of, it's the elites in Washington who are doing all this bad stuff to us, and what we need is more people power. And those are not the right terms to think about this. And you get worse manifestations of this as well. And one of the worst is that because this is a package deal, this idea of an elite is a package deal, and worse in that it's just trying to destroy our understanding and the importance of knowledge. Because of that, what you get is the idea that anyone could be doing this. We should devolve these questions to people and have votes and all kinds of crazy things that don't make sense, because there really are issues where you need knowledge, and to attack it and to assume that you don't, it means that you're attacking people who have a value that's important to our lives. So, I mean, suppose you were dealing with a problem where real medical knowledge was necessary. It's like, you know, all these phenomenons, all these cases of what happens when someone comes along who is bearing a virus we don't know much about. Well, you can't just magic out of your hat what the answers should be. You need to talk to people who study that field of medicine, and you need to figure out, well, what can we know about this, and what are the questions to figure out here? And the idea that, well, if only we didn't have elites, everything would be all right, and if people could vote on things, well, that doesn't begin to address these kinds of problems. Notice what happens when you have this anti-concept. You're caught, either you're for it or against it. Well, but that overlooks the important distinctions of, do we need people who really understand issues and understand this context and understand these problems or not? And at the same time, do we need people who have bad ideas, or do we need people who have good ideas? And do we need people who want government to do its proper function, or people who want to arrogate more power to government? All those things are run together, and you're supposed to answer the verdict, yes or no, elites, we need them or we don't. Well, that's not a question you can answer, one, because of the terms in which it's framed. And it might sound like it's sort of setting up a straw man, oh, either you have elites or you don't. Well, in a certain way, you can't avoid that problem once you misconceptualize, or you really warp our understanding of what this issue is. So there's different manifestations of this, and you see it in all sorts of areas. And I've just been touching on the context of foreign policy elites in recent history. And there's a lot to criticize. So none of what I've said so far should be a get out of jail free card for the people who led America into the Iraq War, or who orchestrated the policies under President Bush and Obama that have been so ruinous to us in the Middle East and in other places. In my book, Winning the Unwinnable War, the big thrust of that book is that the people shaping our policy, the intellectuals and the policymakers, they're on the hook. They should be blamed. And it's not by virtue of their knowing things and having expertise, but it's precisely because of the ideas that they do hold and the irrational policies that follow from them. So it's important to separate out that what is deserving of criticism and what is not, which you can't do easily, or you can't do clearly, if you traffic in a package deal like elites in the way in which it's used in these attacks and these arguments. I mean, the other thing that's important to get here is this is just another indication of the broader phenomenon, that there's lots of strings and threads that come out of it. which is there's a certain anti-intellectualism that it springs from, or that sometimes is manifested in this way. And that's a bad thing. But again, it's, do you need intellectuals? Do they serve an important function in a culture? Are they helping people to make sense of the world and to guide them towards success and happiness? Yes, they are needed and necessary. Are intellectuals who are now leading society or have done for the last few hundred years, have they been the right intellectuals, the good ones? No, they have not. And that is because of the ideas and doctrines that they have advocated, not because of their role as intellectuals. So, and this is a theme that Ayn Rand has raised in her writings. Intellectuals are necessary for our society and for our culture and for individual life. We need philosophy, and we need the people who apply it and explain it and teach it and write about it and implement it. But we need them to apply the right ideas. So it's important to see that there's important functions to be filled, and that they have to be filled by people whose, and what you want are people whose ideas are good and productive and pro individual rights and pro freedom. And that when they're not, when they're collectivists and when they're trying to expand government and control your, that's a bad thing. It's a hugely destructive, and we've seen that over the last century and longer. So this goes to the wider issue of the role of philosophic ideas in society, in that to rail against intellectuals is to buy into some of those premises that lead people to think that philosophy doesn't matter. And in fact, it does matter. It matters. It is a fundamental factor in society and in culture and in policy. And it's important to separate out what it is that you're attacking. Are you attacking the people who led us into the Iraq war, particularly the neoconservatives under Bush, and who deserve the blame that is heaped upon them, as if, in my view? That is legitimate. That's important, and it has to be done. That doesn't mean that everyone who's engaged in foreign policy, who has depth of knowledge, deserves blame and should be evicted from their function. That's not the way to think of it. You have to judge the quality of what they advocate and not be confused by this issue, which I think is one of the functions of this concept of, or this package deal of elites, as it's widely used in these debates. So we're going to take a quick break here, and we'll be back in just a moment.
With adoring fans, rabid critics, and very few in between, why does Atlas Shrugged evoke such impassioned responses? Because it grapples with the fundamental problems of human existence, and it presents radically new answers. Atlas Shrugged challenges many conventional notions about good and evil, that sex is a low animal desire, that money is the root of evil, that man is sinful by nature. One of the most prominent is the notion that selfishness is evil and self-sacrifice is good. Atlas Shrugged is a dramatization of Ayn Rand's unique vision of existence and of man's highest potential. 12 years in the writing, it is her masterwork. Rand's worldview emerges in the plot turns of this compelling mystery, centered on one question: who is John Galt? There are many legends. Which of these is true? Is he the man who discovered the Fountain of Youth? The man who found the lost city of Atlantis? A modern Prometheus? Does he even exist? And why, if no one knows the answer, does the entire world know his name? Find out the answer when you read the novel that sparked a philosophical revolution. Order it today on Amazon.com.
The Ayn Rand Institute campus is an exciting online destination offering free e-courses on Ayn Rand and her revolutionary philosophy of objectivism. Whether you recently picked up your first Rand book or have been reading her novels and nonfiction for years, ARI Campus has something for you. On campus, you'll discover a variety of multimedia courses covering Rand's literary classics, specific aspects of thought, and how to apply her ideas to your life. Get started today at campus.aynrand.org. See you on campus.
In 1934, Ayn Rand wrote to journalist and essayist H.L. Mencken, "Perhaps it may seem a lost cause at present, and there are those who will say that I am too late, that I can only hope to be the last fighter for a mode of thinking which has no place in the future. But I do not think so. I intend to be the first one in a new battle, which the world needs as it has never needed before, the first to answer the many too many advocates of collectivism and answer them in a manner which will not be forgotten." Every day at ARI, we work to make sure that Ayn Rand's answer will not be forgotten. Help us. Contribute today at AynRand.org/support.
The Ayn Rand Institute's mission is to promote Ayn Rand's philosophy of reason, rational self-interest, and laissez-faire capitalism. We are currently looking for talented, passionate, and bright people who share our goal of advancing Ayn Rand's ideas in the world. The Ayn Rand Institute offers you the opportunity to impact the culture and make a difference each and every day. If you're interested in working at the Ayn Rand Institute, visit us at AynRand.org today. There you'll find details on employment opportunities and how to apply.
The critics of income inequality say they are for social justice. But what does that mean? It means that if you are really productive, if you work hard, create a lot of wealth, and make a lot of money, you're doing something bad. You're creating inequality. So what's fair? Well, some say what's fair is to have the government take a bunch of your money and give it to other people. Why do these people deserve to be given money from others? The answer is because they didn't create much wealth. That's what it all comes down to. Social justice says we should punish people who have done nothing wrong for the sake of people who have not been wronged. On the other hand, justice says we should only punish people for the wrong they've done to others. For more on inequality, see the new book by Yaron Brook and Don Watkins, Equal is Unfair, America's Misguided Fight Against Income Inequality, out in bookstores everywhere on March 29th. For more information, go to equalisunfair.com. That's equalisunfair.com.
Welcome back. This is the Yaron Brook Show. I'm Ilan Jerno from the Ayn Rand Institute, filling in for Yaron this week. We have been talking about this debate, or let's not dignify it by calling it a debate, but this issue of, do we need foreign policy elites? And I've been arguing that the way that issue is framed is wrong. The conceptualization here is wrong. And that the whole concept of an elite as it's used in this context is not valid. It's a package deal in Ayn Rand's terms. It pulls together things that should be separated out. They're different. And essential here is that expertise and knowledge, and particularly a superlative degree of knowledge and expertise and ability, are of value. And that's important and it's necessary in key areas of life and in different functions where the specialized knowledge is inescapable. At the same time, that concept of a package deal of an elite brings together the idea of power over you, sort of the influence of such people in government and shaping policy. And many of them are power seeking, which is itself a problem. So that goes into it. And what goes into it as well is the failure or the evasion in some cases to distinguish between the ideas that people hold and whether they're good ideas or bad ideas, namely these experts and the so-called elite, because you could imagine quite easily that there be people with a great degree of knowledge who are advocating the right ideas and whose purpose is to shape government to be limited to its proper function of protecting rights, not seeking to be the next czar over the size of soda containers or the czar over some other segment of our lives or the czar of us over foreign policy. And that it is critical to evaluate the ideas of elites and separate them out and evaluate them as good or bad and not take it as one big package without those distinctions, because then you end up attacking things that are necessary and important and valuable along with things that deserve criticism. And so you're put in a bind and it's hard to think about those issues. And then the arguments pull you in opposite directions. Well, look at the Iraq War, look at Vietnam. That's what foreign policy elites led us to. And at the same time, you can't just have someone walk off the street or even someone with a modicum of knowledge navigate some of these difficult issues. So, but how do you account for that? Well, this is part of what I'm arguing, is that if you separate out what is thrown into this package deal of elites, then you can actually evaluate and make sense of what's happening and advocate for the right things and the right ideas and the right direction. So part of what I'm driving at here is to show, was to illustrate a way in which when the conceptualization is off and seriously wrong, that does a lot to destroy our thinking. It clouds our understanding of what's happening, and it undermines our ability to sort out what needs to be criticized, what needs to be changed, and so on. And that in looking at this sort of issue, if someone says to you, oh, are you for the elites or against them? Do you think we need them in government or not? That's not a yes or no answer. And it boxes you in a way, precisely because of the conceptualization that is so wrong at the heart of it. It's asking you to throw out good things along with the bad things, to simplify it. And this is one of the lessons in studying Ayn Rand, which is she is a master at sorting between and identifying conceptualizations that are illegitimate and invalid. And some of them, and I suspect this is one of them, are designed to cloud our thinking. And she called those anti-concepts because they're trying to replace a legitimate concept in our minds that is needed to understand the world. And she thought, for example, that the moral concept of duty was not just an invalid concept and a package deal, but it was an anti-concept. It was designed to destroy our ability to think about morality. And if you're interested in that, I would recommend her essay, Causality versus Duty, which is an amazing philosophic essay. And it's presented in terms of what it looks like in your own life. So it's several degrees removed from the topic I've been covering here, which is the foreign policy elite. Are you for them or against them, and why that's not the way to think about the issue. So let me draw a line here and just highlight that there's a lot more to say about this issue. I just wanted to indicate what it looks like to unpack it and why it's essential to unpack it. And to, sort of the widest theme here is that the ideas we use, the concepts we accept are important. And so be on the lookout and be critical. And if you remember in Ayn Rand's essay, Philosophy, Who Needs It?, one of the things she brings to mind and underscores is that people easily take on concepts from the culture around them uncritically. And that has real consequences. And our knowledge stands or falls on the strength of our conceptions, our concepts. So part of her advice in that essay is be conscious of what you accept. Don't have a mongrel philosophy of accepting some things and just being buffeted by what you absorb passively in society. Be critical, be active, and think about what's going on. And part of what that means is subject the concepts you hear and are integral to these debates to analysis. Understand what they are trying to point to, sort them out, and bring your own moral principles and political principles to bear. So it should grate on you to hear that something like this is happening. It bothers me not just because I'm interested in foreign policy, but the idea that one could have an animosity towards the elite. Well, what could be behind that? Because so obviously in other areas of life, we admire people who are in an elite position. I mentioned people like Michael Jordan and people in the military. And there's so many other contexts where that is obvious. So what is it different about these elites? And is it even a valid way to think about them? What is it that is being put under this heading of elites? Okay, so perhaps we'll come back to this another time because I think there's more to say about the issue. And I'm interested in your thoughts on this. So when you hear the program, you can send me questions or comments on Twitter. My handle is @ElanJourno, ElanJourno. I look forward to hearing from you, particularly if this is a topic that resonates with you, or if you have follow-ups on it. And for most of the articles that I'm talking about in today's program, I'll try to do this for all of them. I'll gather the URLs and we'll put them on the show notes on ARI's blog, Voices for Reason, which you can find at ari.aynrand.org/blog. We'll have some of those links there for you if you're interested in reading the articles yourself, which I encourage you to do because I think there's much more in them than I've had time to cover. All right, let me switch gears and tell you about something coming up. This is an event I'm in June, which is one called Atlas Shrugged Revolution Dinner Chicago. Now, you might have heard Yaron or some of the other guest hosts talk about our Atlas Shrugged Revolution dinner in New York City, which happens in September, and we're having that again this year. But the Chicago event is similar in its purpose, is to bring together people who are fans of the novel and who are admirers of Ayn Rand and her ideas. And there'll be talks. The speakers at the event will be Yaron Brook, Dmitry Balyazny, who's one of the sponsors of the event, Joe Walsh, who is a well-known personality on radio in Chicago area on AM 560, and one of my colleagues, Don Watkins, who, along with Yaron, is the author of the new book, Equal is Unfair, which I'm sure you've heard about in the break. It's a really fun event. I've been to the one in New York. I haven't been to the one in Chicago, but I can I know similar vibe. There's often an auction of Ayn Rand memorabilia, and I think there will be one here. But above all, it's just a fun evening and a dinner and celebrating real values in the world, things that have changed our lives and changed the world. I think Atlas Shrugged is a book that has done both of those things. So if you're interested, you don't have to be in Chicago, because we live in the world of air travel, trains, cars, and boats. And so if you're interested in attending, you have time to sign up. You can go to aynrand.org/Chicago and find out more about the event, the speakers, read their bios. And I don't think they have the menu, but my experience is the food is usually exquisite. So if you're a foodie as I am, it is definitely worth your while. And I encourage you to learn more about it. So that is Atlas Shrugged Revolution Dinner Chicago, June 7th, coming up very soon. Great. So let's switch gears and talk about something that is, how should we say? It's sort of an evergreen topic, unfortunately. And I say unfortunately because when you study the Middle East, which is what I've been doing for the last few years, it's surprising if your exposure to it is just from the headlines, and I understand many people's exposure to it is just from the headlines. Every other day, there's some other crisis, some other turmoil, some other revolution, anarchy, horrendous attacks by terrorists and so on. But what's interesting, the more you study it, as I have, there's a certain kind of regularity to it, or certain themes that come out, I should say, and patterns. And it's interesting from many perspectives, but I guess I would put it this way. So the deeper one's knowledge of the region and the politics and the culture, the more intelligible it becomes, which is, I think, an obvious point. But also what happens is that what you see is that the things that look like and are in the moment crises, and who could have seen this happen, who could have seen this coming kind of phenomena, are much less surprising. And not that they're necessarily predictable, because people have free will and there's all sorts of factors that go into it, in a kind of deterministic sense, predictable. But that they're not fundamentally surprising, because they are the playing out of certain trends that, if you follow the region and understand it, you will see that those trends are on the rise, and certain events, they fit that trend. So they shouldn't be surprising. So that's a setup for a topic that most people listening, I suspect, may not remember. So I want to give you kind of a flashback. And it leads into the project that I'm working on, which I want to tell you about, which is my book. The current title of which is Unprincipled: Why American Policy Undermined Israel and Empowered the Jihadists. And I put a big footnote on that, which is I haven't decided if that's the final title for the book, but that gives you a flavor of what the subject is and sort of my angle on it, which I'll elaborate on a bit more as we go. So the particular event that I want to talk about and indicate how it fits a pattern and where it comes from is, it's about, it happened 10 years ago. And that's why I think most people won't remember it. So 10 years ago, let me just cast your mind back. George W. Bush was in the White House. He had launched America on a what I call a crusade for democracy in the Middle East. This is the subject we take up in the book, Winning the Unwinnable War, along Iran and my former colleague Alex Epstein. We wrote about this in that book. The idea there was, after 9/11, what America needed was to bring democracy to the Middle East as a means of supposedly eliminating the threat of terrorism. And our view at the Ayn Rand Institute was that that was completely wrong, not just in its execution, which was terrible, but that in its conception, its origin, and its goals, it was a self-sacrificial goal. It did not serve America's interests. It did not make us safer. And I think time has borne out the truth of that. So that's the wide angle picture of what was happening about 10 years ago. So that if you recall, or if you look into this, you'll see that Bush's view was that we will bring democracy to Iraq. That will be a beacon for the rest of the Middle East. And from there on, there will be an unstoppable tidal wave of democratization, which will thereby transform the Middle East, and you know, everything else will be hunky-dory. So that's the wide angle picture. One of the areas that Bush focused on was the Palestinian territories. And by that I mean the areas that had fallen to the control of the Palestinian Authority. Without getting into the hyper-detailed backstory, as a result of a peace agreement signed in 1993, Israel ceded territories to an institution called the Palestinian Authority, which is a state in the making, with the idea that eventually it would become an independent Palestinian state. That didn't go the way it was supposed to, according to the plan, and instead there was essentially a terror war launched by the leaders of the Palestinian movement. And this became horrific series of suicide bombings and attacks. And this all happened, it began in 2000 and it sort of climaxed in the first administration of George W. Bush. And Bush's reaction to this was, well, they just need better government. And if only they had better institutions, they wouldn't be all this suicide bombing and terrorism coming from the Palestinian Authority. So they need to have elections. And from elections, they will vote the better people, and that will be the end of it. And I'm not. If you detect any sarcasm or sort of a sardonic tone in my voice, I'm not trying to make it sound silly, and I'm not trying to make it sound ridiculous, even though in hindsight it might look that way. And to me and others at the time, it was irrational. But nevertheless, it was hailed as a smart policy. So here's what happened. Basically, every premise of that policy that Bush advocated for was dead wrong. One of the premises was, if they had better leaders and better government and more transparency, and if they filled the potholes in the streets, they'd be too busy serving their constituents to worry about trying to launch attacks and doing terrorism. And, you know, the business of government is such a burden that the people expect them to offer good schools and to offer good health care, that, you know, once that happens, society changes in a very stark direction. That was not even remotely true. And don't take my word for it. Let's look at the election result. So the election result that I'm referring to is in January 2006, so almost exactly 10 years ago, the Palestinian Authority had legislative elections. So there's sort of a pseudo, if you want to call it a parliament, though, I don't know if it quite is a parliament. They had elections. And the outcome of that is that not that they were good or worse people, but it's the worser people, if you will, won by a landslide. And I'm referring to Hamas. And Hamas, for those who aren't aware of it, is an Islamist organization. Its name is an acronym for the Islamic Resistance Movement. Hamas is a jihadist movement. It seeks to create a theocracy under Islamic rule. It is notorious for suicide bombings. Everything that you might conceivably, I mean, before there was ISIS, Hamas was up there in terms of its brutality, though ISIS has eclipsed it, I think, in some ways. So this is what happened. And the Bush administration, and this is, I was doing research on this recently, and it's fascinating to reread these statements from the White House and Condoleezza Rice, who was the Secretary of State at the time. I think they really were surprised. And one of Condoleezza Rice's first statements was, I called the State Department to confirm the news that I saw on TV. And I don't know why nobody saw it coming. I mean, I asked everybody, they didn't see it coming. I don't know how that's possible. And then you get, once the shock of it subsided, what happened is they started spinning it in a certain way to make it look like, oh, yeah, well, this sort of fits our policy. And yeah, we can cope with this and it's going to be difficult and we have to do stuff. But, we can cope with this. And it was so clearly not true that they could cope with it and that they didn't see this coming. And they were blindsided. And this is one of the topics I write about in my book at length, because I think it's revealing of both the thinking of the Bush administration and also of the foreign policy circles in Washington at the time and the way they view this. So I set up this topic earlier when we were transitioning to it by saying, if you really look at the Middle East, certain things strike you as a crisis and surprises. But they shouldn't, in a certain way, because if you see the important trends and you understand the dynamics, it makes a lot of sense why the Palestinians, when they had one of the first free and fair elections, and there was remarkably no obvious tampering as there are in many elections around the world, and remarkably this election was blessed by international observers, so that it doesn't get more kosher than that, basically. And given that option, what the Palestinian people who voted chose to do by a significant margin, which I think is rightly called a landslide, they chose the jihadists, the people seeking a theocracy who would make their lives actually harder and who have been waging a war against Israel in various forms. This is before the significant number of rocket attacks, before the war. And if you remember, there was a war between Israel and Gaza in 2008-09 and in 2012 and in 2014. That was before that all happened. Anyway, this opened the door to that by enabling Hamas to rise to power. My basic point here is that the result that Hamas won this election illustrates the wider trend that the Bush administration was actively ignoring, and I think they were evading this, which was, at the time, if you looked at the Middle East, the most significant trend ideologically was that the Islamist movement, or the jihadists more broadly, were on the ascent. They were becoming more, they were getting more followers. They were able to get more people to join their ranks and carry out attacks. They had a moral stature that past intellectual movements, or sort of political ideological movements more specifically, no longer had. So if you look at the region 30 years ago, so that would have been the late 60s, 70s, at the time there was a lot of questioning of what should we be about, what ideas should we follow. The previous dominant ideology was Arab nationalism, and it was on the wane significantly after 1967, and for a long time it declined. But since then, since 67 and onward, and especially after 1979 with the revolution in Iran that brought a jihadist regime to power, that is the movement that has been gaining momentum and credibility in people's eyes as something to look up to, people who we should admire. That's the regional trend, and it plays out on a micro level within the Palestinian community or the Palestinian society. So people have, there was a book I read that was published in 1993, I believe, by a scholar at a university in the West Bank, who I think is, as far as I can tell, he's not sympathetic to any particular Palestinian faction, but you know, he's just giving an analysis from the perspective of a Palestinian scholar looking at his community, who are the intellectual leaders and what's going on. And the book is a fair treatment of the rivalry between the ideological camps within Palestinian society. And I mean, you can read the book yourself, and there's many treatments that basically capture the same data, and they conceptualize it in similar ways, which is, after the nationalist, Arab nationalist movement loses its luster and credibility and moral standing in people's eyes, as that wanes, what comes to replace it is the Islamists, Hamas being the most well-known, but there were others. And that had been happening since 1988, at least, within the Palestinian community. And it just grew and grew. And there was ebbs and flows. But basically, that was the trajectory. The Islamists were gaining stature at the expense of all the other ideological groups among the Palestinians. And it surprises many people to know these days, given how prominent Hamas has become. But you know, if you rewind 30 years ago, the Palestinian community was heavily influenced by communism, Marxist ideas, and that with that brings a kind of secularism. So it's interesting to see that the trend has been away from that and towards piety, religiosity, and more sort of an active pursuit of a jihad, in effect. And the reconceptualizing of the Palestinian cause towards a jihad. So that was all in the background. And that I don't think reputable intellectuals could ignore that as a trend in the region and in the Palestinian Authority. Palestinian community and in the authority itself. Now, this goes back to the earlier point about foreign policy elite. It's not that people weren't aware of that, but I think they had ideas about what should be true about the Palestinians that overrode their actual knowledge. And they things that they see but refuse to acknowledge and evade that makes them sort of putting a wish above an it is, in effect. And so this is an example of how if you have irrational ideas about what society looks like and what animates people. So Bush's premise was deep in the heart of every human being, there's an innate desire for freedom. That is part of what led him to advocate for democracy among the Palestinian community and then across the Middle East. That is not true. It's a false premise. It's worse than false. But if that's a premise of your view, then and you have a hand in shaping policy, you will be led to advocate for having elections where the outcome is almost certainly going to go in the direction of where the ideological trend has been pointing, if not immediately, then over the long term. So this is a case of how irrational ideas are a fundamental factor in corrupting policy. So I was reading an article, actually, it came out in January, right on the anniversary of the Hamas win, by a scholar whose work I've followed for a number of years. It's actually pretty good. It was in Newsweek. It's basically, it's 10 years since Hamas came to power. So just let that sink in. Not just as evidence of how wrong Bush was about what the Palestinians really wanted at the time or since, but just it's become, in effect, a mini state now, Gaza, where Hamas has its stronghold. Excuse me. And this is, so it's been 10 years. That is a long time. And what has happened there has been similarly predictable if you see the trends, which is, did Hamas become busy fixing potholes? And did the business of governing really make it lose sight of its ideological goal? To ask the question is ridiculous now. And it seems like who could possibly ask that question? Because it answers itself if you just glance at the last few years. Hamas has been busy digging tunnels for carrying out attacks on Israel and has been busy building and launching rockets And if it could, I think it would send suicide bombers, although that tactic is lost. It's a lot harder to implement. So I think this is a case of what it looks like when the people shaping foreign policy are not simply, it's not that they're ignorant, it's that they refuse to acknowledge the fact. And they refuse to acknowledge the fact because the ideas that they adopt and hold are wrong and they're irrational. And that is a significant factor in understanding how bad the outcomes are and why they're so bad. So that's a way of amplifying the point I was discussing earlier about this whole issue of the foreign policy elite. I don't doubt for a minute that the people who were reporting to Condoleezza Rice were brilliant, probably the best in their PhD programs, their master's programs, whatever it is that they got their training. I'm sure they assemble people with outstanding qualifications. And I don't buy the argument that it's incompetence. I mean, I'm sure there is a lot of incompetence in government. That is just a fact of reality, I think. I don't think it is a the causal explanation. I don't find it plausible. And I don't think that's how things are. I don't think it is remotely a sufficient account of it. And I don't think stupidity is either, which goes along with that. So there's you know, people who favor those. And I think those are a way of avoiding the more challenging issue of, well, why did they hold these views? And why did they disregard certain data about the region, about the politics within the Palestinian community? Well, those are hard questions for people to grapple with. And to appreciate that those are crucial questions, you have to have an appreciation of the role of philosophic ideas in policy and in shaping people's views about the world. So that is one thing that triggered my thinking on this, and particularly reading this essay in Newsweek that I referred to, which is really interesting because the gist of this article is it's been 10 years since Hamas took over. They can't get along with the other Palestinian faction that has control over a different part of the Palestinian territories. And it's crazy to think that there could ever be peace between the Palestinians and Israel if the Palestinians are fighting among themselves, and they are fighting among themselves, which is an important point and deserves to be amplified. So that was one reason I wanted to raise this topic, to illustrate the point about what it is that's going on in our foreign policy, the role of fundamental ideas in shaping it. But I also want to talk a little about my book, which is taking up a lot of my time, and I'm enjoying it. It's fun. There are ups and downs, as with any big project, but I want to tell you a bit about it to tell you what it is I'm working on, and to give you a heads up, because I can't tell you exactly when it's going to come out, but it's coming out. It could be a matter of months. It could be a bit longer. It depends on how the publishing process works out. And I mentioned the title of the book, so let me say a bit about that. I'm calling it Unprincipled, Why America's Foreign Policy Undercut Israel and Empowered Jihadists. And let me say a bit about why that's the title right now, and it might change. I'm thinking about what it should be. Part of what the book shows in looking at the Middle East, and specifically America's role in trying to bring peace between Israel and its adversaries, is that our policy has been irrational, and what a common thread among the different administrations, the last three administrations, Clinton, George W. Bush, and Barack Obama, one common thread, which I think will surprise people, is that, number one, that there is a common thread, and I think there is, but the one thing that unites them is that in different ways, they push aside the issue of evaluating morally the standing of the adversaries in the conflict. And that shapes the policies that they push and that they try to implement in America's role as a mediator or a broker for peace. And it's a fresh perspective on a topic that's being given a lot of attention. So I think there's value in that. And the subtitle, the idea of undercutting Israel and empowering jihadists, there's a lot to say about that, and that's why there's a book. But the preview point that I want to present to you is I think there's an interesting way in which America's relationship with Israel is not well understood. So it's often thought of primarily in terms of material aid. So there's a great deal of American military aid and support and training and so forth and technology and in financial support that goes from the U.S. to Israel. I think it outstrips other countries in terms of U.S. aid of this kind. And there's a lot to say about that, and I don't think it's a good thing to do. But what's overlooked is much more salient and I think underappreciated point, which is the absence of a real understanding of Israel's character and a moral stand with it, which I think is lacking. And I show that even with George W. Bush, who has the reputation, not just in the eyes of his opponents and critics, but in the eyes of people who like him, as Israel's best friend in years to sit in the White House. So I take on those considerations. I also argue against the kind of views that you hear on college campuses and in certain sectors of the media, which is that America has done too much in favor of Israel. And my argument is that's not true. Quite the opposite is true. And arguments about why it's detrimental for America to be allied with Israel. And I take on that view and I explain my view, which is very different. We have suffered as a result of our relationship with Israel, but not because it's been too supportive. It's a different problem. And then the other element of the subtitle is that the encouraging of jihadists. Part of what the book aims to do is to relate the consequences of America's policy in the region and specifically in the context of the Israel conflict or the Arab-Israeli conflict or Israel-Palestine conflict, and to indicate sort of that conflict as a microcosm of the larger trends in the region, which is, I think, the rise of jihadists in the region. So there's definitely ways in which, and I've indicated one in which how Bush's policy enabled Hamas to rise to power, which it would not have had otherwise. So I think the book presents a distinctive take on the last few administrations' policy and broader implications than Israel and the Palestinian conflict. The other thing I wanted to say about the book is my aim in writing it is to present, I think, a distinctively objectivist perspective on this issue and to illustrate what that looks like in practice. I'm editing the book, and it's going to take a lot of editing to get it to where I want it to be, and that's what I'm working on these days. But I think it makes a really valuable point about how philosophic ideas, and particularly moral ideas, are not just important but unavoidable and inescapable in the conduct of our foreign policy. And so we need to have better ideas and a better moral perspective. That's one of the takeaways from the book. But all of this is just as a way of preview. I know hearing all that, it sounds like an infomercial. And guess what? I hope it does prove to be an infomercial in this sense, which is to get you excited about it and interested. And when the book comes out, you'll consider buying it and reading it. And I'm sure I'll be back on the show to talk about it at that time. If you're interested, what I recommend is that you want to get updates or learn more about it, is you can follow me on Twitter. And my handle is at ElonJourno. I'm getting that mixed up. My handle is at ElonJourno, ElanJourno. And of course, you can sign up to get ARI updates and emails from us and get our newsletter. If you go to our website, put your name in there and you'll find out more. And I'll also be speaking about it at the conference, at the Objectivist Summer Conference, which I mentioned earlier, happening in Seattle in July. And about that, again, I encourage you to sign up and come along. Okay, we'll take a quick break and I'll be right back.
Ayn Rand was a radical thinker whose philosophical novels challenged students to reconsider their views on fundamental issues. The Fountainhead, Atlas Shrugged, and Anthem. These works have become classics of American literature that never fail to engage young people and stimulate intense classroom discussion. By offering these works for free to teachers, the Ayn Rand Institute hopes to encourage greater awareness and understanding of Rand's stimulating perspective. If you're a teacher who would like Ayn Rand's books in your classroom, visit AynRand.org. This is at no cost to you. Go to AynRand.org today.
When The Fountainhead was first published more than 70 years ago, Ayn Rand's bold literary vision and groundbreaking philosophy of individualism captured the world's attention. Initially rejected by 12 publishers as too intellectual, the novel became an instant classic and continues to provoke heated debates. What motivates a creative thinker? Is it a selfless desire to benefit mankind, a hunger for fame, fortune, and accolades, the need to prove superiority, or is it a self-sufficient drive to pursue a creative vision independent of others' needs or opinions? Ayn Rand addresses these questions through her portrayal of Howard Roark, an innovative architect who, as she puts, struggles for the integrity of his creative work against every form of social opposition. It's also the story of his love affair with a woman who seeks to defeat him. The Fountainhead is as relevant today as it was when Rand first penned it. The novel was also a personal landmark for Rand. In Howard Roark, she presented for the first time the uniquely Ayn Rand hero, man as he could be and ought to be. Order your copy today at Amazon.com.
You didn't build that. You don't pay your fair share. Who do you think you are? Ayn Rand knew exactly who you are. Rational, productive, independent, you work hard and use your own judgment. You choose your career path, your lifestyle, your values. You're living the American dream. And now you see that there are people who want to take away what you've created and will call their lust to loot a virtue. People who think the needs of others is a claim on your money, your work, your life. Well, how can you fight back? That's what they do at the Ayn Rand Institute. They look closely at public policy beyond sound bites and election cycles, at the fundamental moral ideas that frame crucial debates. They focus on reframing the issues in line with reason, egoism, and individual rights to life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of happiness. Your life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of your happiness. Stand up with them to fight against the sacrifice of your values by making a contribution today at AynRand.org/support. They'll use your money to defend your values.
How does economic inequality emerge in a free society? From a bunch of win-win transactions. When J.K. Rowling wrote her Harry Potter books, she created something of value. Seven great stories for which millions of people willingly and happily paid $10 or even $20 apiece. Now, what happened to inequality as a result? It grew. Rowling became a billionaire, starting from poverty, while her fans saw their income stay the same and their wealth go down by a tiny amount, that same $10 or $20 per book. Income inequality grew, but everyone was better off as a result. Everyone won through these win-win exchanges. That's the way inequality arises under freedom, and that's why it should. For more on inequality, see the new book by Yaron Brook and Don Watkins, Equal is Unfair, America's Misguided Fight Against Income Inequality, out in bookstores everywhere on March 29th. For more information, go to equalisunfair.com. That's equalisunfair.com.
Welcome back to the Yaron Brook Show. This is Ilan Jerno. I'm sitting in for Yaron this week. And we're just going to wind up the show with a recommendation, something that I think you'll find valuable and interesting. I know Yaron typically does this at the end of his programs. I gather last week he didn't get to do that. I think he was running to the airport. So apologies for that if you missed it. But let me offer something this week that I think you'll find engaging. I've started reading a book that I want you to be aware of if you're not, and if you are, I want to encourage you that it might be something valuable for you to read as a way of enriching your knowledge and improving your understanding of Ayn Rand's ideas. That book is A Companion to Ayn Rand. It is edited by Alan Gotthelf and Greg Salmieri. It is an excellent book. I've, as far as I've read through it, I'm about, I think, close to halfway. It is a superb guide to Ayn Rand's ideas, and it presents her not in a sense of here's what she says and you should agree and it's obviously true and so on. Not at all like that. It's intended as a guide and orientation. So the assignment that the authors gave to themselves, and I think they succeed at this, is to lay out what she stood for, interpret her articles and writings and explain them, present her views, her arguments, the evidence that she points to, and enable the reader to learn on their own and understand it and form their own evaluation. And I think you will, people who will do and who really think about it will come to agree with her, because I think her view is compelling and true. But it's important that the book is an orientation. And I think that's part of what makes it so valuable. It's an access you can gain from it, whether you've been reading Ayn Rand for many years or if you're just coming to her and want to sort out what you think of her. And this book, one of the things I would recommend it, one reason I would recommend it is it helps one conceptualize what it looks like to understand Ayn Rand. And understand means more than just pressing a like button or favoriting something on Twitter, in effect. I mean, it takes a lot more than putting your thumb up and saying, yep, that's good, or resonates with me, which is a lot of people's view of what it means to understand a view or agree with it. Understanding means a lot more than that. And it means at least that one sees what the argument is, what the position is, the reasons for it, how it fits in the big picture of the system, of the philosophical system, and what is the evidence for it? Because there should be evidence if it's true. It relates to reality and it integrates the facts in a certain way. And that is what the book, I think, offers people. And it, one of the things it does is it's comprehensive. It provides the broad sweep of what she was interested in. So it touches on her fiction writing. It touches on her philosophic writing. And it also touches on her cultural commentary. There's just an incredible amount of material here. I would recommend this book. I want you to go and explore it and read it. I highly recommend it. If you buy it, go for the Kindle edition because it is affordable. It's at just around $30. This is a big book, so that's a good value. And there's a lot of value in the content, of course. You might be surprised if you look for the hardcover or the hard copy. It is priced for libraries, which I regard as a euphemism for it. Pretty expensive. Don't let that discourage you. It's definitely worth reading, even if only electronically. So it's a companion to Ayn Rand. Highly recommend it. In particular, I would highlight one of the essays. I got to read this a little earlier than release because I happened to meet Greg and we were talking about it, and he was kind enough to send me a draft of this chapter. It's called A Philosopher on Her Times, Ayn Rand's Political and Cultural Commentary. It is an excellent overview and an analysis of Ayn Rand's cultural commentary, which is just really good synthesis of what she has to say and presenting her views. And that's written by John David Lewis and Greg Salmieri. So that's one of my favorite pieces in the piece. And there's definitely a lot in here. One thing I would say is if I haven't convinced you yet, let me make one more pitch, and that is listen to Greg in an interview he gave recently. He spoke to a publication called The Undercurrent, and I'll put a link to the article in the show notes. It's an interview about the book, The Companion, and about campus culture today and the relationship between Ayn Rand's views of the culture on campuses years ago and some of the implications for today and how to understand it. One of the things that's so interesting about the interview, and it's a point that Greg makes in the introduction to The Companion as well, is it presents what it means to take seriously Ayn Rand's ideas, which I take to be to engage with them intellectually, to understand them and take them seriously, which I find that valuable, and I think you might too. And that is the interview is interesting in its own right, whether you are converted to buying the book or not. But I certainly hope you'll consider it. There is just a wealth of material here, and many contributors. I'm not going to name them all, but people who are definitely in a position to be writing on the subject. They've spent a long time thinking about Ayn Rand's ideas, and they're qualified. Eminently qualified to be explaining her or interpreting her ideas to people interested in learning about Ayn Rand in a serious way. The other thing I would say is, especially for people who are in college, undergrad, graduate school, it can be very difficult or challenging, rather, to navigate the intellectual landscape on university campuses and to figure out, well, where does Ayn Rand fit here? What would her ideas imply? How would she answer this? What would her theory of this be? And to the extent that one can situate her in the intellectual landscape, one of the things that this book does is it helps guide one to forming that kind of view of, okay, here's what I'm facing in my college classes. Here's a class on philosophy. Here's a class on social in politics, or here's a class on, you pick a field that has some humanities implications to it. And I'm sure there's other kinds of examples you can come up with. What would it look like to take Ayn Rand's philosophic perspective and figure out this field? Where would she sit? Who would she agree with? What, to what extent? The book doesn't give exhaustive answers to that, but it points you in the direction to how to think about that. And in my experience, situating a thinker, any thinker, in the intellectual landscape of that field is incredibly helpful in understanding them and understanding the field as well. And that's part of what it means to be in college, is to gain knowledge about these issues. So that is a superb reason for you to consider this. It'll help guide your thinking and understanding. And I think it will lead you towards a deeper understanding of Ayn Rand's ideas as well. It's valuable in combination, of course, with Ayn Rand's own writings and the writings of Leonard Peikoff, which I regard as, obviously you should start by reading Ayn Rand, but to help guide you in understanding her philosophy, which is a big undertaking and a valuable undertaking, this book is certainly a valuable companion, and so it's aptly named. With that, let's draw to a close. Thank you for listening. I hope to connect with you guys next time. It's been my pleasure to talk with you today and to fill in for Yaron. I don't think he's back next week. I think I might be back myself. I'm looking forward to it. Until then, goodbye. And I hope you'll connect with us online on the web at aynrand.org and on Twitter and Facebook. I don't have one. I have a handle. It's Ilan Jerno. And I hope to talk to you next time. Thanks a lot.